Time on this Monday afternoon here at WWNO to welcome you to the first Monday edition of All Things New Orleans. As part of our new program schedule, WWNO will present two airings of ATNO each week at this time now and at its continuing original time on Thursdays at 6:30. I'm Jack Hopke. One of the features on today's program, I'll let you know, ran last Thursday evening on our program, but since it's a different time of day and it's a good spot, we thought we'd give you another opportunity to hear it. You'll find it enjoyable. Sometimes our Thursday broadcasts will repeat all or some of Monday's edition, and sometimes each will contain different material. In any case, we welcome you, and we hope you've been enjoying our new lineup so far today. The Library of Congress announced recently that a woman with extensive Louisiana connections, Natasha Trethewey, will be the next Poet Laureate of the United States, one of the youngest poets ever selected for that honor. Trethewey spoke with Fresh Air's Terry Gross a few years ago after she'd won the Pulitzer Prize for her book Native Guard. The book is a collection of personal poems which discuss her youth as a biracial child in the South. They discuss the murder of her mother, and they discuss the Native Guards as well. That's a regiment of former slaves fighting for the Union in the Civil War.
How old were you when your parents divorced?
I was 6.
And then you went to live with your mother.
That's right. My mother and my father divorced during the time that my father was getting his PhD at Tulane. And we had been commuting back and forth from Gulfport to New Orleans, which was about an hour's drive. We had an apartment in Gulfport, and my father had a roommate in New Orleans that he would go and stay with during the week for class. And sometimes we'd go and visit him on the weekends, or he'd come to Gulfport. And so it seemed like a very gentle transition, strangely, for me when they actually divorced and my mother and I moved to Atlanta for my mother to start graduate school.
Did it change your racial identity when there was no longer like a white father in your home?
Well, I can't say that it changed my racial identity, because though I was a biracial child and my parents talked to me about what they thought that meant, I also understood that I was a black child, and that didn't change.
There's three main subjects that you write about in Native Guard. There's the murder of your mother, who was murdered by your stepfather, from whom she was divorced. There's poems about growing up biracial and about the marriage between, you know, your mother's first marriage to your father, who was white. Then the middle section of the book is a series of 10 poems. I believe they're sonnets. About the Native Guard. Tell us the story of the Louisiana Native Guard.
Well, the Louisiana Native Guards were the first officially sanctioned regiment of African-American soldiers for the Union Army in the Civil War, and they were mustered into service in September, October, and November of 1862. And the 2nd Regiment was stationed just off the coast of my hometown, Gulfport, Mississippi, on Ship Island, where there was a fort called Fort Massachusetts, and they were there to guard Confederate prisoners.
And were these mostly ex-slaves?
Well, the 2nd Regiment actually was made up primarily of former slaves. The 1st Regiment was made up of a lot of free men of color from Louisiana, many of whom might have been slave owners themselves. In the 2nd Regiment, there was a Major Dumas, who was the son of a white Creole father and a mulatto or octoroon mother. When his father died, he inherited a plantation and all of its slaves. And though he was someone who did not agree with slavery or want to hold slaves, it was illegal in Louisiana at the time for him to manumit those slaves. But when the Union Army started recruiting black soldiers and mustering these troops, he joined, and he freed his slaves and encouraged the men of age to join as well.
Now, the first sonnet I'm going to ask you to read from this cycle of sonnets about the Native Guard is called April 1863, and it relates to an incident during the Civil War, a battle in Pascagoula. Tell us the story of Pascagoula before you read it.
Pascagoula is another town near Gulfport, and there was a skirmish in April of 1863 between the 2nd Regiment of the Native Guards and some Confederate troops. Toward the end of the battle, the black soldiers, the Native Guards, were retreating back toward the beach so that they could board the ship and go back to the fort on the island. And at that point, it was time for the Union sailors who were on board the ship to fire at the enemy to give them a little bit of protection so that they could get back, they could retreat safely and get back on the ship. Instead of doing that, the sailors fired directly at the Native Guards, their own Union soldiers.
And why did they do that?
Well, some historians who've written about the island have talked about that there had been a little bit of tension on the island between some white troops from the Northeast, Union troops who were there, and the Native Guards. These white troops not wanting to interact, take orders from, or whatever, the black troops.
These poems that you've written about the Native Guard, whose voice are you writing them in?
I am writing in the voice of, the imagined voice of one of the men who might have been a former slave of Major Dumas and who then would have been freed and enlisted in the 2nd Regiment.
And the 2nd Regiment, is that the regiment that was fired on by white soldiers from the north?
Yes, it is. The 2nd Regiment is the one that was stationed at Ship Island guarding Confederate prisoners and was fired upon.
Would you read April 1863 and then June 1863 for us?
Yes, I'd be happy to. April 1863. When men die, we eat their share of hardtack, trying not to recall their hollow sockets, the worm stitch of their cheeks. Today we buried the last of our dead from Pascagoula and those who died retreating to our ship, white sailors in blue firing upon us as if we were the enemy. I'd thought the fighting over, then watched a man fall beside me, knees first as in prayer, then another, his arms outstretched as if borne upon the cross. Smoke that rose from each gun seemed a soul departing. The colonel said, an unfortunate incident, said, their name shall deck the page of history. June, 1863. Some name shall deck the page of history as it is written on stone. Some will not. Yesterday, word came of colored troops dead on the battlefield at Port Hudson, how General Banks was heard to say, I have no dead there, and left them unclaimed. Last night I dreamt their eyes still open, dim, clouded as the eyes of fish washed ashore, yet fixed, staring back at me. Still more come today, eager to enlist, their bodies, haggard faces, gaunt limbs, bring news of the mainland. Starved, they suffer like our prisoners. Dying, they plead for what we do not have to give. Death makes equals of us all. A fair master.
My guest is Natasha Trethewey. You won the Pulitzer Prize. It's certainly, you know, one of the absolute highest honors an American writer can, you know, an American poet can get. Do you feel like it's changed your life in any way?
I don't know how I'll think about this a year from now or whatever, even a few months from now, in terms of it changing my life. But I think that what I'm most delighted with is that I received the honor at this time in my life for a book that tries to honor the memory of my mother. I was 40 the day that they called to tell me that I'd won. The same age my mother was when she died, and I was also just shy of my 41st birthday. And I knew years ago that I was writing this book, and I wanted it to, in terms of the timing, to appear at this moment for me, because reaching that age was very symbolic for me. What I couldn't have imagined is that it would have been honored in this way.
Natasha Trethewey, congratulations on your Pulitzer. Thank you so much for speaking to us and to reading some of your poems for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. This has been delightful.
We've been listening to Terry Gross's interview with Natasha Trethewey, a professor of creative writing at Emory University in Atlanta, a native of Gulfport, Mississippi. Trethewey has been appointed the newest poet laureate by the Library of Congress. And this is All Things New Orleans for Monday, July 23rd. Good afternoon to you, Jack Hopke, along with you. For WWNO. Of course, one of the things we've been broadcasting on all our news and information programs is the speculation about whom Mitt Romney will pick as a running mate. NPR's taking a closer look at some of the contenders. Our governor, Bobby Jindal, is an Indian American with a compelling life story, but even though he could help energize the GOP ticket, there are questions whether he would be a safe pick. NPR's Jeff Brady has a profile.
Mention Bobby Jindal, and a lot of people still remember his 2009 Republican response to President Obama's first address before Congress.
My own parents came to this country from a distant land. When they arrived in Baton Rouge, my mother was already 4.5 months pregnant. I was what folks in the insurance industry now call a pre-existing condition.
Even conservatives called the speech stiff and uninspired. But now, as a surrogate for Mitt Romney, his message is polished and pointed.
President Obama, the most liberal, incompetent president since Jimmy Carter, never ran anything, including a lemonade stand, before we elected him president of the United States. Let's add him to the 23 million unemployed Americans. Let's elect Mitt Romney president.
That was Jindal in Pittsburgh a few weeks back. In the GOP primary, he supported Texas Governor Rick Perry. But now he's clearly on Mitt Romney's team. On Wednesday, Jindal was in Columbus, where the State House News Bureau of Ohio Public Radio asked if he wants to be Romney's vice president.
We're referring all VP questions to the campaign, but this election is not about Joe Biden. It's about Governor Romney versus President Obama. Two very different records, two very different resumes, two very different visions for America.
While Jindal is quick to change the topic, his name is frequently mentioned. He has an impressive resume. After college, a Rhodes Scholarship, and a stint with a management consulting firm, Jindal was appointed Secretary of the Louisiana Department of Health and Hospitals. He was only 24 years old. At 33, he was elected to Congress, and 3 years later, governor. Jindal was widely praised for leading a huge pre-hurricane evacuation 3 years after the failed response to Katrina. He also earned high marks for his response to BP's oil spill in 2010. And Jindal is very good at raising campaign money. John McGinnis writes the political newsletter Law Politics Weekly in Baton Rouge.
Where he does his very best is in a very small rooms filled with very rich people. Then he's great. You know, he'll lighten their wallets every time.
McGinnis says Jindal would be a safe pick for Mitt Romney ideologically. Even though 1/5 of Louisiana residents don't have health insurance, Jindal is an unsparing critic of President Obama's health care overhaul. He opposed the law's expansion of Medicaid. And McGinnis says in his second term as governor, Jindal has maintained his reputation as a fiscal conservative.
Most importantly for the Republicans, he has not raised taxes, and he's even, in one case, vetoed the renewal of a 4-cent cigarette tax, which there was absolutely no opposition to.
That hardline approach appeals to an important voting bloc in the Republican Party, conservative evangelical Christians. Jindal converted from Hinduism to Catholicism in his teens. Given his firm opposition to abortion rights and gay marriage, he's on good footing with evangelicals. As an Indian American, he would add some sizzle to the Romney ticket, says Michael Cromarty with the Ethics and Public Policy Center.
I think there are many people in the Republican Party who want to be seen as an inclusive party, and so it would add in the dynamic running against President Obama to have somebody of a different ethnicity.
But Cromartie says there could be one problem. Jindal is only 41 years old.
And he has the benefit of looking like he's about 20, but that may not help him politically.
Cromartie says he thinks Jindal is ready, but he suspects some voters would rather see a few more gray hairs before Bobby Jindal advances to a national office like vice president. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Jeff Brady's an NPR National Desk reporter based out of Philadelphia. Monday, All Things New Orleans, WWNO, Jack Hopke along with you on this 23rd. Time to hear about another of our own, Bobby Charles. You know the name? Well, he was one of those rock and roll figures whose work you're almost certainly familiar with, even though you may never have heard of that name. He lived in isolation, he recorded very little, he never performed, and he died back in 2010. Here's rock historian Ed Ward to tell us about the memorable body of work he left behind.
They'll take your love and your money. They'll take your sugar and your honey. They'll take your skin and your fat. Wild people like that. They'll take your child and your home.
When he was around 13, Robert Charles Guidry began singing with a band around his hometown of Abbeville, Louisiana, deep in the Cajun swamps. The band played Cajun music and country music, and, after he passed through town and played a show, Fats Domino's music. It was a life-changing experience for the young man, and he found himself with a new ambition, to write a song for Fats. One night as he left a gig, he said to his friends, "See you later, alligator," and one of them yelled back, "In a while, crocodile." Bobby stopped in his tracks. "What did you say?" he asked. The friend repeated it. At that moment, as would happen countless times in the future, a song came to him, fully formed.
Well, I saw my baby walking with another man today. Well, I saw my baby walking with another man today. When I asked her what's the matter, this is what I heard her say. See you later, alligator. After a while, crocodile.
Fats didn't want the song, and he told the young man he didn't want to sing about alligators. Somehow, though, the kid wound up singing the song over the phone to Leonard Chess, whose Chess Records in Chicago was the hottest blues label in town. Chess didn't hesitate. He sent the kid a ticket, and when Bobby showed up at his office, Chess said something I can't say on the air. The sentence ended with the word white and a question mark, though. Chess recorded him and put the song out, changing Guidry's name to Bobby Charles. And almost immediately, Bill Haley grabbed it for himself. Haley's record was one of the bestsellers of 1956, and both Chess and Bobby made some decent money from it. Bobby recorded for Chess until 1958, but his records only sold locally. Along the way, though, he seems to have pioneered a genre called swamp pop.
Ain't got no home. Ain't got no place to go. Since my baby been gone, things ain't the same no more. She used to hold my hand.
He also got to realize a dream. One evening, Fats Domino played Abbeville, and Fats invited Bobby to a show in New Orleans. Bobby said he had no way to get there. "Well," the fat man said, "you better start walking." And sure enough, a song popped into Bobby's head.
Ain't
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm gonna need to parachute when I get through walking these blues. When I get back to New Orleans.
Bobby signed with Imperial, Fats' label, but again nothing hit. He admitted freely that he was part of the problem. He didn't enjoy touring, and he had a jealous wife who didn't like him leaving town. He continued writing and selling songs and recorded for some local Louisiana labels. He and his wife parted company, and then in 1971, he got busted for pot in Nashville. Rather than risk jail, he disappeared. He wound up in upstate New York and saw the name Woodstock on a map. He'd never even heard of the famous festival, but the name appealed to him. Arriving in town, he asked a real estate agent about a place to rent and wound up in a house shared with two other musicians. They introduced him around, and Albert Grossman, who'd managed Bob Dylan, Janis Joplin, and many others, got interested. The next thing he knew, Bobby was back in the studio with members of the band, Dr. John, and lots of other Woodstock musicians. The resulting album had some truly memorable moments.
It's all small town talk. You know how people are. They can't stand to see someone else do what they like. It's all small town talk. You mustn't pay no mind. Don't believe a word they'll try to do. Everything you hear, and only half of what you see. And if you're gonna believe in anyone, you gotta believe in me. It's all small town talk.
It didn't sell, though. Bobby focused on songwriting, but he wasn't comfortable in Woodstock, and in the end he went back to Abbeville, where he disappeared from public view for an entire decade. He had a good income from his songs, but a run of bad luck. His house burned down, and then his next house blew away in a hurricane. He kept writing songs, and he entertained visitors who came to Abbeville to meet him, people like Bob Dylan and Neil Young and Willie Nelson. His record label, Rice and Gravy, put out several homemade albums which mixed his old and new songs.
I don't know why I love you, but I do. I don't know why I cry so, but I do. I only know I'm lonely, and that I want you only. I don't know why I love you, but I do.
At the age of 70, Bobby Charles was diagnosed with cancer, and he died in January 2010. Unknown to most of the world, he'd enriched with his songs.
I don't know why.
Probably know that song best by Frogman Henry.
I don't know why I cry so.
Our contributor to All Things New Orleans today, Ed Ward, he lives and writes in France. He's a regular contributor to Fresh Air, too.
I'm lonely, and that I want you only. I don't know why I love you, but I do.
I'm Jack Hopke, and this is All Things New Orleans, our weekly news magazine. A reminder, you can hear us twice a week now. Our first broadcast of the week with this program is Monday afternoons at 1:30. Coming up at 7 o'clock tonight, Fresh Air. On Royal Street in our French Quarter, you'll find one building, in one building, I should say, a museum, a research center, and a publishing house. And although this institution is nearly 50 years old, It's often passed by tourists and locals alike. On this week's Notes from New Orleans, Sharon Litwin speaks with the director of this overlooked French Quarter cultural experience.
Summer in New Orleans is not always conducive to long walks through the French Quarter with out-of-town guests who have no clue how hot hot really is. As beautiful as our streets are, many summer days are best spent indoors, especially in the heat of the day. There's a house on Royal Street, a beautiful house on Royal Street, where we can actually go to do that. But it's my bet many of us have never done it. 533 Royal Street has a pristine, if somewhat intimidating, exterior. So you can't blame passers-by for wondering whether they should even step into the carriageway.
I would tell them that the architecture may seem foreboding because it is right on the street. It's a granite facade right on the street. But that's the way things were built in the 18th century. And if you just step inside the carriageway, a whole world will open up of beauty and history. It's just a wonderful place.
That's Priscilla Lawrence. She is the director of the Historic New Orleans Collection, an avid and devoted protector of everything about this city's history and culture, past and present, and the official hostess, if you will, of one of the most interesting archives in this country.
The Historic New Orleans Collection is a museum and a publisher and a research center in the French Quarter in New Orleans and is very dedicated to that area. General and Mrs. Kemper Williams started the Historic New Orleans Collection because they were very interested in the French Quarter at a time when not many people were. In the late 1930s, they purchased a building that was built in 1792. They realized the importance of the historic structure and wanted to preserve it. The general was one of the first commissioners of the Vieux Carré Commission, and he was very interested in preservation. He also loved collecting, and so did Mrs. Williams. So things just sort of grew.
General Kemper Williams, a native of Paterson, Louisiana, married New Orleans native Lelia Hardy Moore in 1920. From that time on, both became ardent lovers of the quarter and collectors of important Louisiana documents, a role now being carried forward by Priscilla Lawrence. She's been part of the HNOC for 32 years, the past 12 as director, and she's watched as the collection has expanded over those decades, building for itself a national reputation.
My favorite way to explain it is that it's about New Orleans and Louisiana history in a national and international context. The richness of our culture involves so many different areas and people, and it's so much fun. It's so interesting, and there are so many stories to tell in so many different avenues.
Now the collection possesses hundreds of thousands of precious objects, artworks, and papers, primary documents going back to the very beginnings of New Orleans. When that kind of collecting happens in institutions, they inevitably run out of space. That's true about HNOC. Over the years, they have acquired other buildings, always deciding to stay in the quarter. They renovated a major building in the 400 block of Charter Streets, turning it into their reading room.
Now, there's a new addition to that complex, and it's an 1821 building that has been in the Perriott and Destrehan families over the years. We call it the Perriott Building, and it is now providing space for additional staff. We're really excited. We've just been moving in over the last 2 or 3 weeks and haven't had an official opening, but it's a stunningly beautiful addition to the complex on Charter Street.
The really endearing part of the HNOC is its absolute dedication to the public. Oh, of course, scholars come from around the world to do research, but you and I can also go in there and find out the history, say, on the past 2 New Orleans World's Fairs, or the stories of any number of lesser-known jazz musicians, or so much more. The buildings themselves are the exquisitely restored and unique examples of some of this country's most beautiful architecture. So next time you have a little time to spare, or you just want to get out of the heat, think about stepping into 533 Royal Street. You won't regret it. For more information about the Historic New Orleans Collection, go to wwno.org or nolavie.com. For WWNO, I'm Sharon Litwin.
Sharon Litwin is the co-founder of NOLAVIE.com. More information about the historic New Orleans collection can be found online at hnoc.org. And that's our first Monday edition of All Things New Orleans. Hope you've enjoyed it. We also air on Thursday evenings at 6:30, and sometimes we'll have different material too, so we hope you check us out both times of the week. All our features are archived at WWNO.org. I'm Jack Hopke, your producer and host, and I work with associate producer and editor Thomas Walsh in bringing you All Things New Orleans. Stay tuned for Tell Me More.